From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. This week, Congress reauthorized the Patriot Act without much debate, but with the full-throated support of the Obama administration.
Our hope is that these provisions will be reauthorized for as long as we possibly can. If they were done on a permanent basis, that is not something that we would object to.
That was Attorney General Eric Holder, apparently not as concerned as privacy advocates were about the act's potential impact on civil liberties, nor were most legislators. When Kentucky Senator Rand Paul objected to federal searches of gun records, Democratic Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid accused Paul of being soft on terror. Meanwhile, Oregon Senator Ron Wyden suggested that the government is secretly interpreting the act even more broadly than generally assumed. Washingtonian magazine reporter Shane Harris is the author of The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State. He summarizes the three most controversial provisions of the act.
One that allows them to place multiple wiretaps when they're tracking a single individual. It's called the roving wiretap. Another is something called the business records provision, which allows them to obtain all kinds of different records. It could be hotel records, rental car, credit card receipts, etc. And a third is something called the lone wolf provision, which allows the government to start surveillance on someone even if they can't show that he's connected to a terrorist organization or is a foreign agent or a spy.
What is the political climate that permits, you know, what appears to be an incursion into the Bill of Rights to occur with so little public debate?
When these reauthorization debates come up, there is this line that gets drawn in the sand, and members have to choose between being on the side of law enforcement and intelligence agencies and giving them the tools they need to catch terrorists and bad guys, or being on the other side.
In fact, when Senator Rand Paul, the Republican from Kentucky, a libertarian, tried to raise issues concerning the reauthorization, Senator Harry Reid, the majority leader in the Senate, denounced him essentially as soft on terror.
That's right. And he said that if Senator Paul did not stop his efforts to try and block passage of the reauthorization, that he was giving al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups an opportunity to start plotting against the United States, which is quite an exaggeration considering any of the surveillance going on right now of terrorist organizations would continue even if the Patriot Act expired. Law enforcement and intelligence agencies wouldn't be able to get new authorizations until the law was renewed. But to sort of cast it in these terms, the way that Senator Reid did really gives you a sense of how really kind of binary this debate becomes when it's taken up at the 11th hour like this, which it so frequently is.
And on the subject of 11th hours, this week, just before Congress took up the issue, there was a bombshell from Senator Ron Wyden, who revealed that there could be secrecy within the secrecy embedded in this act.
I believe there are two Patriot Acts in America. The first is the text of the law itself, and the second is the government's secret interpretation of what they believe the law means.
It turns out that according to Senator Wyden and Senator Udall, that there is some kind of very broad interpretation of the Patriot Act that the government is making and that is essentially keeping to itself. And he couldn't talk about this in great detail without violating his confidentiality oath, he said. But what he's implying is that there is something within the business records provision, one of these provisions that was up for reauthorization and that generally lets the FBI collect all kinds of records, that is being very broadly interpreted to, in the senator's view, allow the FBI to get more information than the law actually allows it to get. And what's very important here is he's not saying that he wants the government to come out and say, what are you collecting? What he wants some public light on is the legal rationale for why it is they're interpreting the provision this way. It raises the question of whether or not there is a secret Patriot Act within the Patriot Act.
If Senator Wyden is right, this is happening under the Barack Obama administration, which campaigned against this kind of overreach. Is it that governments, once they have police powers, simply do not want to surrender them?
I think that's right. They tend to increase over time, and no administration wants to get rid of them. This administration, particularly, which is deeply committed to breaking up terrorist groups, to attacking al-Qaeda. This is the president that ordered, you know, the killing of Osama bin Laden, after all. They look at these tools in the Patriot Act and others as absolutely essential to doing that.
When, however, a society begins to trade some of its basic freedoms for security, isn't it time to have what the president calls an adult conversation?
Absolutely. And I think what's remarkable about this late revelation with the Patriot Act, if it's in fact true that the administration is interpreting it in secret behind closed doors, that would be extraordinary, probably for any administration. I think it will now really fall, frankly, to journalists and to some other members of Congress to find out what exactly this interpretation is and if the senators are overly concerned about it. But right now, I would probably err on the side of being extremely skeptical of what the administration is doing.
All right, Shane. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Shane Harris is a reporter for The Washingtonian and author of The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State. If the tension between our democratic values and our national security is under-debated here, such debate seems to be entirely absent in Iraq, a nation the U.S. government invaded 8 years ago with an eye to cultivating democracy in the Middle East. Protests in many of Iraq's biggest cities against the government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki have been suppressed, along with the media attempting to cover them. According to Human Rights Watchers, journalists in Iraq today are confronting tactics nearly as brutal as those used by Saddam Hussein. Sherry Riccardi, an expert on Middle Eastern media, says the current state of Iraqi media is eerily reminiscent of the not-so-distant past.
Journalists throughout the country, not just in Baghdad, but throughout the country, have been harassed by the security forces, detained, assaulted, and there have been these terrible middle-of-the-night raids on newspaper newsrooms, radio and television stations where they break in. If anybody's there, they intimidate them. If they're not, they raid the place, they take computers. And this has been going on for quite a while now, and it's getting worse, not better.
Tell me about the TV station called Nahlia.
Nahlia was the TV channel that was, right when the protests started, that they were attacked brutally. After they filmed the unrest in Sulaymaniyah, 50 or 60 mass gunmen rushed the studio, raided it, destroyed all of the equipment, and set the building ablaze, which is the ultimate statement of we are totally destroying you.
To what extent are these outlying episodes, and to what extent does it characterize business as usual under the Maliki government?
There's one journalist that I talked extensively to by email, and his name is Mohammed Al-Kazi. And he described to me how he survives, because that was the question I asked all of them, how are you surviving today in Iraq? And he told me the story about how he climbs out of bed every morning before the school bus arrives to pick up his kids. And he said, I grab a broom handle and I stand back as far as I can from the front door and I poke it wide open a couple of times to make sure no one has come in during the night to attach a bomb to it. And he went on to talk about how once his kids are safely on their way and he goes out to the car to go to work, that he gets down on his hands and knees and checks under the car for an explosive device. And the most stunning thing, he said, is that murdering a journalist in Iraq is easier than running a red light. He said, you know, life here is really awful for us. And so I thought, okay, there's one guy. I'll talk to some more. And I did. And all of them tell a similar story of how they survived. Mohammed told me that he uses four different names and four different identity cards when he moves to these checkpoints in various neighborhoods and towns because of the sectarian and political differences. And he said he even changes his appearance when he goes out to Baghdad or Mosul or Fallujah.
What's his beat that he has to employ tradecraft just to go to work in the morning?
Because he reports on corruption. And he tells stories about how things are not getting better in Iraq, how, you know, there still is spotty electricity, there's no clean water. And I asked him, I said, who do you think, if there would be an attack against you, where would it come from? And he said, I can't answer that. It could come from anywhere. It could be the government is mad at me. It could be some insurgent group is angry at something I reported. He said, this is it for all of us. The Iraqi journalists I interviewed for my report showed very, very little confidence that the situation would improve in Iraq's current political setting. They didn't see it. And I would ask them several different ways, and I would get the same answer. As long as things stay like they are politically here, nothing's going to change for us. It's just going to get worse.
I want to ask you about the chilling effect. And let's begin with the protests that I mentioned in the introduction. I have to tell you, I was utterly unaware that there had been any street protests in these Iraqi cities, not necessarily calling for regime change, but calling for accountability. They somehow escaped my attention. Do you know why?
The chilling effect is really very serious because the brutality has been so bad that they pull back their coverage. They say, wait a minute, what's going to happen to us if we go back into the square or if we go back to cover that protest? So there's the effect of them pulling back to save themselves because they've seen their colleagues brutalized, and then there's more self-censorship. What are we going to report that's going to get us in trouble and get our media outlet shut down? To me, when a government attacks and represses the media, that's so important that it has to be noticed, especially when the U.S. government continues to pour so much money into that country. My report says that they've invested more than $500 million just in media development of U.S. taxpayer dollars. I think the media should be asking, what did we get for that? And I think we would find that if what we got was a far cry from what the Pentagon planners wanted when they began this, even before the invasion, when they began planning for reconstructing the media.
And what about the Maliki government? What have they said?
They condemn the violence. It's a public relations way of dealing with it. We strongly condemn the violence against journalists, and we are doing all we can. Well, no, they're not doing all they can. They're not arresting people who kill journalists. And their own security forces are operating with impunity to attack journalists. And it may be that only our State Department can push them to that, working and collaborating with groups within that country who are very courageous, and they're fighting a hard battle, and they're losing in a lot of ways.
Sherry, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Sherry Riccardi wrote the report for the Center for International Media Assistance. She teaches at Indiana University's School of Journalism. Coming up, a new law aims to criminalize undercover reporting. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by TNT, presenting Men of a Certain Age, returning with new episodes this summer, starring Ray Romano, Scott Bakula, and Andre Brower, premiering Wednesday, June 1st on TNT. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. And now for some of your letters, comments, and tweets. We heard from many of you after we aired the segment on whether the Obama administration should have made the decision to release a photo of Osama bin Laden's corpse. Ann Hubbard wrote, quote, "I did not agree with celebration of his death. I was not saddened. I thought it was necessary. Obama is right. This is not who we are. There is something medieval about gloating over a body, and I believe that's what this is about. I have no doubt that the image would show up on T-shirts and targets." Chris from Chicago took the opposing view. "I would like to see the photo released." He wrote, "I know it seems wrong to some people, but our country was hurt badly on September 11th, and most people I know couldn't help but feel happy when we heard of his death. War is hell, and there's no shortage of pictures detailing that. The Abu Ghraib pictures, the towers collapsing, etc. We are visual people who use images to tell our stories. A picture of bin Laden dead, while brutal, would help millions of people feel a little bit of closure in this situation." For that segment, I spoke with Paul Waldman of the American Prospect, who was advocating for the photos to be released, and the New Yorker's Philip Gurevich, who thought they should not be. Towards the end of the interview, they had this discussion. Paul Waldman speaks first.
"We didn't need the photograph of the Marines raising the flag at Iwo Jima to make us understand that we had won World War II, but it communicated a great deal about what we understood about that event, what it was supposed to represent, what it was supposed to tell us about us."
The image of Iwo Jima is exactly the opposite. It happens also to be a staged reenactment, as we now know.
Many of you responded to Gurevich's point that the photo of Iwo Jima was staged. Listener Brian Vargo writes, quote, "It is irresponsible to let someone say that on air. I cannot fathom how a program titled On the Media would allow something like that to go unchallenged." And listener Ben Bradley concurred, "My grandfather is in that picture," he wrote. "I would like you to know that the flag-raising picture was not staged." Tim Zinnen brought the facts to bear on the issue when he wrote, quote, "Please correct for your listeners the statement your guest from The New Yorker made that the photo of the flag-raising at Iwo Jima was staged. It was not. It was a snapshot of the raising of a second, larger flag. To say the photo was staged gives the wrong impression that the photographer directed the placement and positioning of the Marines and corpsmen. There's a difference between a staged photo and a photo of a staged event. All flag raisings are staged events." The issue has sparked years of controversy, and we've addressed it on the show before. To say the photograph was staged is wrong. However, it was also not of the original triumphal moment. As listener Tim Zinnen wrote, the photo captured the raising of a second flag. Photographer Joe Rosenthal, who took the image, has never disputed that fact. Please keep all of your feedback coming. To email us, go to our website, onthemedia.org. You can also post comments on our site. And for more back and forth with us, friend us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at onthemedia, all one word. About 100 years ago, a novelist named Upton Sinclair went undercover in the meatpacking industry to portray the plight of immigrant America. The resulting book, The Jungle, was so evocative and so disturbing that it changed how the country thought about its food supply and its factory workers. Countless journalists have since employed the same undercover tactic, many of them to expose the hidden corners of our food supply. But two states, Iowa and Minnesota, are now considering legislation that would effectively criminalize such reporting. A third state, Florida, failed to pass its own similar bill earlier this month. Will Potter is the author of Green is the New Red. He says the various bills all have some key provisions in common.
They all include very similar provisions, prohibitions against any audio or film recording of what takes place in so-called animal enterprises and agriculture enterprises, including factory farms, animal experimentation facilities, puppy mills, fur farms. So these bills are actually so broad that anyone who not only is involved in the investigation, but merely possesses the video or audio recording could be targeted through them.
It would cover not only activists who may be motivated to kind of cook the books in the reporting, but journalists or anyone else for that matter, reporting factually, truthfully, and without any sort of preconceived ideology.
And also, even among the people that clearly have politics, who clearly have an interest or they're working for a group like the Humane Society or Mercy for Animals, another animal protection group, they haven't been accused of doing something like cooking the books. I mean, their video documentation has been publicly available, and industry has had a bad public image because of that, but there hasn't been a challenge to the accuracy of what takes place on those tapes.
There's an axiom in reporting to find out who benefits. A corollary to that might be who is lobbying on behalf of. Who is lobbying on behalf of legislation that would criminalize undercover reporting?
All the usual suspects. For instance, in Iowa, Florida, and Minnesota, some of the politicians who have been the most vocal in support of it have either worked themselves for the pork and agriculture industries, or they're on different boards of directors of organizations, or they've been guest speakers. I mean, they all publicly tout this on their campaign websites, the ties that they have to these industries, because depending on the states they're from, that helps them get elected.
Let us agree that if we were confronted with video of an abattoir, we couldn't help but confront the nitty-gritty of how we get our meat. Is it necessarily fair to the producers of meat who maybe are running as ethical an operation as you could possibly imagine to suffer the consequences of the public being just pummeled with shocking images?
Well, and one thing the industry has been saying is that these organizations are compiling the worst of the worst. And there's certainly some truth to that, but also these organizations are documenting what's truly standard industry practice. And I think that should be the takeaway of this, is that the standard industry practices, when exposed to the public, are just as egregious and just as offensive. Most people don't understand what a factory farm actually is and how 99% of the industry operates. And I think that's what the real concern is, that if that's exposed, we're going to need another series of systemic changes like we saw after the jungle.
The proposals here are for special legislation. Are there no remedies under existing law in these three states and the other 47 to deal with fraud, to deal with libel, or, you know, any other law that may be broken in the service of collecting this kind of undercover material?
If the companies want to allege that they've been defrauded or defamed or maligned through manufactured video, there are all laws on the books to target all of those things. But that's not what this is about. It's not about a lack of tools available to prosecute. It's about the lack of a political will to do so. And I think that's what's the concern to these industries. They have to make sure that these people doing the investigating are the ones who are guilty. They're the ones who are the criminals and not the people actually engaging in these practices.
It's taken decades in this country for what used to be considered fairly radical views on civil rights and human rights and the environment to become kind of conventional wisdom. Do you get the sense that we are on the cusp because of the kind of videos that the industry, that the agricultural industry is so afraid of, that the society is on the cusp of utterly rethinking what has till now been the norm?
Absolutely. The conclusion that I drew through working on this project for so long is that in a very short amount of time, these social movements have made truly radical advances in how we're thinking about food, transportation, climate change, animal experimentation, logging, all of these issues. If these organizations and activists continue on this path, I mean, they're fundamentally challenging, in my opinion, what it means to be a human being and challenging how we view our interactions with other species and raising very serious ethical, moral, and practical questions about how we should be living our lives. That's a very threatening set of accomplishments.
All right, Will. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Will Potter is author of Green is the New Red, and he blogs at greenisthenewred.com. Phoebe Prince was 15 years old when she committed suicide in January of 2010. The story of her death is heartbreaking. She'd recently moved to Massachusetts from Ireland. Her parents were separating. She struggled with depression, and at her new school, South Hadley High, she was quickly involved in two contentious romantic triangles. Some students, mostly girls, picked on Phoebe. They ridiculed her accent and called her vile names. Then, one day, she ended her life. In the wake of Phoebe's death, the media narrative quickly coalesced into a tragically familiar story. Named the South Hadley Six by the press, it was the mean girls and predatory boys who had bullied Phoebe to death. But the truth is much more complicated, says Slate's Emily Bazelon. She believes the media narrative followed simplistic notions about bullying and its toll, at the expense, ultimately, of the truth. Bazelon says she decided to investigate this story herself after reading some of the early reports about what had happened in South Hadley.
What got me interested in this case was I was reading the early media accounts, too, and I had just started working on a series for Slate about bullying, and I thought, God, what is – this school sounds horrible, and these kids sound so atrocious. What happened? So I went up to the school, and I started saying to the kids, wow, you must feel so relieved that these six kids are gone and you don't have to deal with them anymore because they were clearly terrorizing people. And every kid I talked to kind of looked at me funny and said, no, that's just not what they were like. There was a lot of girl drama going on surrounding Phoebe and these boys and their girlfriends, but it wasn't like that. And the kids who were charged were not kids who we were in any way afraid of. And that made me think there was really a problem in the reporting.
The story might have petered out, but then the local district attorney decided to file felony charges against the six kids who had been implicated in Phoebe's suicide. Do you have any sense that the district attorney was herself influenced by the media attention the case had brought?
I think there was a kind of push and pull effect where the notoriety of the case was part of what prompted the police and the district attorney to investigate. And then once they decided to press charges, the story had a second life in the media. The DA, when she held a press conference and announced the charges, talked about a relentless 3-month campaign of bullying. And she presented the most vicious possible portrayal of these kids and their role. And then that was it. There was no other story because the defense in a case like this really has their hands tied and can't talk in the same way to the media. So the prosecution's version was the only one that we heard for several months.
As I looked at the coverage, not in Slate, but elsewhere, I noticed that all of the six defendants, five of whom were juveniles, were named and had their pictures splashed across the headlines. And I'm not used to seeing that because ordinarily those identities are hidden from public view. What happened here?
You're right. We're not used to seeing that. And what happened was that the district attorney made a very unusual decision. Even among the three kids who were actually charged as juveniles, whose names normally would not have been public, she made the argument in the indictment that these kids had put Phoebe at risk of serious injury, serious bodily harm, and that as a result, it was acceptable to publish their names. This very rarely happens in juvenile cases. And in this case, given the level of media attention, it had a really devastating effect on those three kids.
You managed to score an interview with one of the kids involved in the case, Flannery Mullins. The others had refused across the board to talk to the press. What did you learn from that conversation?
I learned how hard it is to be at the center of a media maelstrom like this, where the problem is it's about proportional punishment, I think. It's not that Flannery had never met Phoebe, had nothing at all to do with this. It's that Flannery saw herself as involved in a conflict with Phoebe over a boy. So for her to hear over and over again that she was at fault for Phoebe Prince's suicide when she hadn't really spoken to Phoebe directly and had had no involvement with her in the 10 days or so before Phoebe's death, that's a really hard pill to swallow. And yet, it was so much the dominant narrative that I think Flannery feels uncertain that she'll ever really be able to shake that. And so she has to figure out how to deal with that.
You spoke to her mother about that, and here's what it sounded like.
Mid-January to all of February was just brutal for Flannery. She would be in the house trapped, basically, because there would be reporters outside banging on the door. Wow. And so she said, Mom, I have to go to work. I don't know what to do. I can't get out. They won't leave. And this happened over and over and over.
Flannery's mother quit her job because she felt like she had to protect her daughter.
This story was very complex and very nuanced. It had to do with Phoebe's own mental state. It had to do with, in some ways, with her own conduct, in addition to cruelties that she was victimized by, none of which nuance came out. On the other hand, the press was dealing with a tragic suicide. It was dealing with an issue that is very much au courant, and it was dealing with a prosecution on felony charges by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. So can you blame the press for, you know, perhaps oversimplifying the facts in the larger good of calling attention to the issue itself?
You know, I think the problem was whether the press's take on this was driven by real reporting or by simply repeating what they were being told by the prosecution. And you're right, this is a really nuanced story. It's hard to get nuanced stories right. But there were real people whose actual lives were on the line in terms of these teenagers and the effect the criminal charges were having on them. And particularly when we're talking about teenagers, they're not adults. There are ways in which we try to shield them. The law does that. You know, we've decided that teenagers can't be subject to the death penalty and they can't be subject to life without parole because they're not fully neurologically developed. They're not the same as adults. And yet all of those lessons seem to be just thrown out the window in this case.
You know, you took some risk in doing these pieces as being perceived yourself as like some sort of apologist for bullies. Tell me why that would be a grotesque mischaracterization.
The idea that we have to scapegoat six kids and saddle them with these serious felony charges, which they faced for a year, in order to have the serious conversation we need to have about this problem, I just can't really accept that, because they are bearing the brunt of responsibility and punishment in a way that seems to me to be vastly out of proportion to what they actually did. And it's not a question of excusing the bad behavior here, but of oversimplifying to the point that the story just doesn't get told in a way that's true. And in the process, creates a second set of victims here.
Emily, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Emily Bazelon is a senior editor at Slate. You can go to Slate to read her full series on this case and to hear her exclusive interview with one of the alleged bullies, Flannery Mullins, and her mother, Jennifer. Coming up, who will come out triumphant in the app war? An Android versus Apple smackdown. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help doctors, lawyers, and executives protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Constant Contact, supporting Small Business Week and offering live seminars across the country. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. The Economist, covering news and ideas from around the world and the connections between them. On newsstands, iPhone and iPad, and at The Economist Online. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. KG Dogfighting is an app for Android phones, available for purchase in the official Android market online, that allows users to, quote, feed, water, train, and fight your virtual dog against the dogs of other players. Needless to say, it's controversial. Various animal rights organizations, a group of Los Angeles police officers, even convicted dogfighter Michael Vick, have all asked Google, which makes the Android operating system, to ban the game. But Android's content policy gives its customers the freedom to choose, more so than, say, Apple, where you won't find KG Dogfighting or anything like it in its app store. Apple maintains much tighter control over what you can download to your iPhone. Too much control, says Harvard Internet Law professor Jonathan Zittrain.
It's not as if I think the republic is going to crumble because Apple chooses to deny an app like a dogfighting simulation, or before that it was a baby shaker app. I mean, for every particular computing platform, it'll be about a nanosecond before somebody comes up with something highly tasteless, objectionable, and offensive to do with it. But the reason that there's a bigger point to it is that this is very new. For 30 years, the idea was you get the computer from the company, and then it's up to you what you want to run on it as the customer. And when you get into a world where once you have the device, the vendor keeps an ongoing role in what code you will run on it, that starts to create a very unusual ecosystem.
However, when you buy an iPhone or an iPad, you certainly do so knowing that you haven't bought into a Wild West environment. Why shouldn't Apple run its business any way it sees fit?
What I see around the corner is the potential for there to come to be an expectation that there is going to be an intermediate vendor that the government or others who are aggrieved can go to change code and content, either looking forward or retroactively. And that does start to be a problem. An example that is almost better than textbook, where George Orwell's 1984 was sold through the Kindle. You could buy it and have it on your Kindle. And Amazon, to its consternation, discovered that the rights had not been properly cleared for this and that it was being sold without the right permissions. In their panic, they went into each and every Kindle and deleted 1984 from the Kindles that had it. It's Orwellian, literally. It's like you don't have 1984. You never had 1984. There's no such book as 1984. Now, in 2010, when that happened, that is I think, an amusing anecdote. Because if you wanted to read 1984, you go to the library, you go to the bookseller, you go to the airport, there's going to be a copy. You fast forward 5 or 10 years, and it's not so clear there will be alternatives. And that kind of hyper-regulability in the longer term is what I worry about.
Objection, Your Honor, on the grounds of quantum leap to conclusions. Neither Amazon, Kindle, nor Apple are the government. They're not censoring anything. They're just acting as gatekeepers. They're upholding their own standards of appropriateness, much in the way that the Washington Post upholds its own standards of appropriateness in the content that it prints, in the way that Walmart chooses not to sell pornography, even though it's perfectly legal to do so. They're gatekeepers, and they're watching the gate. Don't we need more of that?
To the extent that we can make the provision of mobile phone services very portable, so if you don't like one, you can switch to another very easily, then my worries attenuate a little bit. But there are, I think, some fears that, one, it is kind of hard to switch sometimes. You get bought into one platform, particularly as it starts to connect to lots of other functions. If you want to play your iTunes library of songs that you've purchased, you might have to have an iTunes-compatible device sort of thing. Ditto for ebooks. If you have your Kindle book library, that's it. You can leave the Kindle, but you're leaving all your books behind. And there is, I think, the very real and ongoing prospect that these gated communities set up for their own reasons and even for consumer benefit by private parties are very easily conscripted by regulators in ways that can surprise us. And I would not like to see a world in which, because somebody alleges copyright infringement or defamation or obscenity, that the work in question can so readily be retroactively pulled from all the shelves of the digital libraries.
As competition materializes, won't the freedom of choice essentially solve the problems you're fearing before they ever even occur?
Well, one certainly hopes. That would be great. But the story of technology in the mass marketplace is often one of standardization and consolidation. I mean, right now on the World Wide Web, the initial configuration was one of lots and lots of servers and websites. Now we start to see clustering and huddling under cloud computing providers, so that one provider ends up having a lot of power over a lot of sites, and even against its own wishes, being asked by a government to exercise that power over a lot of sites. So the market doesn't always solve it. It's powerful and it can, but especially when what we care about is marginalized content, marginalized code, stuff that maybe the public isn't clamoring for but could prove to be transformative. I recall an earlier incident in which there had been an application for the iPhone looking to the next presidential election and the end of President George W. Bush's term, and it was simply a countdown. And it had a kind of caricature of the president, and it said, counting down to the end of an error. And Apple rejected the app. And the guy reported that he wrote to Steve Jobs and said, come on, this is harmless fun. And Steve Jobs wrote him back and said, look, my personal leanings are roughly democratic, but this is going to be offensive to half my customers. What's the point? I look at the early days of Wikipedia, and I got to say, it was hard to see what the point was. You look at Twitter, and there are people still wondering what the point is. To have to persuade a gatekeeper that there's a point and that those entities are worth having their stuff exposed to consumers who might want it, that is gratuitously adding a layer of review to an ecosystem that for 30 years has succeeded so brilliantly without having one.
One quick follow-up question.
Yeah.
You don't fight dogs, do you?
I have a dog from the shelter, and you won't find me with the dog fighting app. But as Voltaire is supposed to have said, but I think never did, I will go on the radio for the general policy preference that there ought to be an open platform without too much gatekeeping so that stuff can happen.
Fair enough. Just checking your moral purity. Jonathan, as always, a great pleasure.
Of course.
Jonathan Zittrain is a professor of internet law at Harvard and co-director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Zittrin says that companies like Apple should let users make their own decisions rather than relying on a gatekeeper to tell them what's good for them. Of course, there are times on the web where the absence of gatekeepers has created serious maladies. Take cyberchondria. That's when people use internet search engines to diagnose themselves wrongly with terrible illnesses. In 2005, we spoke to Washington Post columnist Carolyn Butler. She had written about her recent bout of cyberchondria.
You have the sort of common things that come up, like too much caffeine, being tired, looking at the computer for too long. But of course, I glossed right over all of those and headed to the big guns, MS and Lou Gehrig's disease.
Because one of the characteristics of cyberchondria being that the more research you do, the sicker you discover you are or may be.
Yes, I mean, I think it's a pretty common occurrence. You have a common symptom, you go online to do a little bit of research, and you are confronted with all of this information. It's sort of information overload. Some of it is good, some of it is not so good, but the more you read of what's out there, the more your anxiety grows, and the more you end up convincing yourself that it's a far more serious situation than it's likely to be. So a headache turns into a brain tumor, or, you know, reaching for a word turns into Alzheimer's.
So you realized early on that you, in fact, were a victim of the tragedy of cyberchondria. And you discovered that others had actually documented this very syndrome. Tell me who has looked into this and what they discovered.
Yes, so there are two researchers out at Microsoft Research who decided to conduct a pretty serious large-scale longitudinal study to see how people really did conduct their medical research online. And they found that about a third of those who were doing medical-related searches escalated their searches in this way.
The whole notion of cyberchondria kind of challenges what hitherto had been a couple of articles of faith. One is that patients should be their own advocates, mm-hmm. and the other is that more information is always better than less information.
A couple of people that I spoke to for this article compared cyberchondria to this idea of medical school students having something called second year syndrome, which is in their second year, they have all of this book information, but they don't yet have the sort of clinical practice, that there is this same phenomenon. Basically, all medical students end up convincing themselves that they have some, you know, rare skin disease or disorder.
I've had this experience twice. 10 years ago, I got it from car dealers who would look at me with exasperation as I came in with more information than they'd bargained on.
Uh-huh.
And they'd say, yeah, you've been on the internet, haven't you? Well, and now I'm getting it from my general practitioner.
Yep. I think this is probably the bane of doctors' existence. I had this with my OB when I was pregnant recently. He sort of told me to step away from Google, that it was not my friend.
Ma'am, step away from the computer. Step away from the computer.
I think a lot of doctors would agree.
If you extrapolate from the findings of the Microsoft research, it seems to me what you would have to conclude is that the internet has made us a society of the worried well, maybe making themselves sick from worry.
Mm-hmm. Also, cost-wise, it's costing our healthcare system a lot of money, perhaps driving people to visit their doctors or hospitals unnecessarily, to do tests that aren't needed as well.
Finally, I just want to get back to your eye tick. That's where we began this conversation. I'm going to just make a wild guess that the diagnosis did not turn out to be Lou Gehrig's disease.
Shockingly, I do not have MS or Lou Gehrig's disease. It turned out I did actually, after all this web surfing, go in to visit my doctor to see what he thought. We figured out that I was actually allergic to a new eye cream. So I'm going to be okay.
Carolyn,
yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Carolyn Butler is a columnist for The Washington Post. Last month, we talked on this show about Twitter bots, accounts on Twitter whose tweets are generated not by people per se, but by a program. Of course, so-called chat bots are all over the internet, usually trying to sell us something, and it's becoming harder and harder to distinguish actual humans from the sophisticated software designed to emulate humans. Longtime technology writer Clive Thompson, who blogs at collisiondetection.net, encountered exactly that dilemma recently when he got a message from someone with the handle BabyGirl01475.
The opening salvo was basically just, you know, hey, what's up? And I had actually seen Baby Girl, et cetera, trying to engage me in chat several days before that. And I'd always just declined. So finally I said, okay, I'm gay, man. I said, oh God, what is it? And they were like, you know, I'm just bored and looking for someone to chat with, which I recognize as the universal opening salvo of someone who's trying to get you to go to some, you know, webcam chat sex site and then give up your credit card. I got interested as to whether or not this was actually a human or a chatbot, because, you know, it wasn't entirely clear.
Now, this sounds already like something called the Turing test, right? Which is for people to, in fact, try to detect whether they're speaking to software or speaking to a live human being. And it's an ongoing measure of how sophisticated semantic web software is, right?
Yeah, that's right. Back around the Second World War, Alan Turing, who was a famous mathematician who helped break the German codes, allowing the Allies to understand the German messages, pioneering computer scientist, he wrote an essay that basically said, you know, is it possible that a computer could be thinking? And he said, let's take off the shelf everything except for like just conversation. Let's say that that's, you know, the marker of whether or not you're really intelligent, whether you're thinking, is whether you can appear to be a convincing human in conversation. And he was talking about like talking on a teletype machine, which is kind of like the chat of the 1940s and 50s, right? And he said, let's imagine that you're sitting in a room and you're talking on a teletype to two entities and you have to try and figure out which one's a human and which one's a machine. And if you can't figure it out, then the machine is effectively human. You can say that it's sort of thinking and passing the Turing test.
So you decided to go all Turing test on whoever was sending you the messages. How did you go about that?
Some of these bots are very sophisticated now. People have been programming these bots for like 10 or 15 years, and they'll have tens of thousands of responses that can seem quite convincing. One of the things that the bots are really bad at doing, though, is they won't be able to talk about something that recently happened, right? So I said, what did you think of Bridesmaids, the movie that just came out? And the bot really just dodged the question, gave me a sort of a canned response. I was pretty sure after that question I was talking to a chatbot.
Now, if the chatbot had responded, oh, super gross, but super funny, then you realize you have been spending time talking to an actual person called Baby Girl. Then what?
The conversation would have gone a very different direction, believe me.
Yeah, okay, but one of the things about engaging online is just because an answer is canned and stiff doesn't mean that it's necessarily coming from a computer. It could be just someone working from a script, right?
Yeah, that's right. So basically, the conversation was, what did you think of Bridesmaids? And the response was, oh, well, I'm still in college right now, and I've been working here online lately, trying out something new, want to check it out, which A, was not an answer to my question, what do you think of Bridesmaids? And B, you know, a transparent gambit to try and get me to probably a sex website. At which point in time, I openly began discussing with the bot something I was wondering, which was this. When you talk to chatbots, you're getting these canned responses. But sometimes when you talk to humans, they're forced by their employer to only say something in the script, right? We've all had this situation. You call a help desk, you're asking a question, and you can hear them clicking the keyboards and they're reading something. Effectively, the human is behaving like a chatbot, right? And so I said, you know, I can't figure out whether you're a chatbot or a human who's working with a preset script that's sufficiently rigid that you appear to be a chatbot. And the fascinating thing was, at that point in time, Baby Girl said to me, no, I'm not a bot. Are you? Whoever or whatever was on the other end of this conversation had thrown the Turing test back in my face. I got very philosophical. I'm like, well, how would I know whether or not it was a chatbot? You know, this is almost like a Blade Runner moment, you know? Is Deckard a replicant or is he not? And so I said, you know, that's an interesting question. How would you be able to tell whether I was one or not? I got a response that didn't follow up on that at all and literally was just like, gave me a link and said, go click on the invite tab. And, you know, there, see, that's clearly a chatbot that has been programmed to respond to the question, are you a chatbot, with no, I'm not a bot, are you?
Right. So how was the website?
No way I was clicking on that link, my friend. That was probably just filled with spyware and spamware and people who would just show up and steal my toaster.
Okay, at this stage, you're certain or almost certain that you're speaking to software. How does it end?
Well, I kept on saying things, making these philosophical points with the Turing test, and finally I realized it's gone away, you know. So my final statement was, I appear to have bored you into silence. And the commenters on my blog all said, you know, that was the most poignant moment when I chased a bot away by boring it.
And actually, if you kept at it, on the verge of being a stalker, Clive.
Yeah, sure. Maybe the bot's talking to the bot saying, don't go near that guy. You know, he's weird. He'll just talk for hours about philosophy. You'll never get a credit card out of him.
Next time we talk, we can talk about the bot restraining order that's been issued. Clive, as always, a delight to talk to you. I'm reasonably sure you're human.
Thank you. And I'm reasonably sure I am, too.
Clive Thompson writes about technology for the New York Times Magazine, Wired Magazine, and on his blog, collisiondetection.net. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Andrew Parsons. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Dylan Keefe. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.